We're talking about how Reedsburg and the Saucony area got internet service here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. It is well established that rural communities in our state desperately need access to broadband. And the Reedsburg Utility Commission in Sauk County created one of the fastest internet systems in the country almost 20 years ago. The public utility, founded in 1894, it provides electricity, water, phone, and, get this, internet services to about 4,400 customers. We're examining their story, what other communities can learn. Do you lack reliable internet? How has it affected your life? Do you live in Reedsburg? What was it like before the utility established service? We're at 800-642-1234. Dave Mikanowicz worked for the Reedsburg Utility Commission for 22 years. As general manager, he oversaw the creation of a broadband internet system. He retired in 2012. Dave, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hello.
All right, so where did this idea come from? You know, in the early 2000s, you started building this infrastructure. What inspired it to get into the internet business?
Basically, it was a need that the utility had ourselves. We wanted to get a fiber loop around the city for our wells and our substations and reservoirs and so forth. And we went to the incumbents, and they wouldn't work with us. They didn't have fiber, so we decided to build our fiber loop that we would use, you know, internally. And as we were doing that, the school system came to us and said, "Say, we'd like to get on that loop too." So then we started, I think we had a 10-year contract with them. We built to them, and that sort of started the ball rolling. And then we, you know, industry started talking to us and other people in the community and said, "Hey, you know, why don't you look at going into the broadband business?" And we ran into a real good, I would call him a coach salesperson, who sold the type of equipment that you needed to put on the end of the fiber to actually do the broadband. And it all sort of grew from that. And we just started overbuilding the city. And then in 2009, Obama had a bunch of stimulus money. Then we applied for that. And that's when we started building the rural area around Reedsburg.
How long did it take to build the infrastructure?
Well, in the city, it took us about 4 to 5 years because we were learning, and we were, you know, we needed revenue coming in, and we had to balance the books with what we were putting into the ground in construction along with the revenue coming in. So it took about 5 years.
And this did cost a community millions of dollars to create. Where did you get that revenue?
It was from local banks that believed in what we were doing. In the very beginning, the electric utility loaned this infant utility, the broadband, I think it was like $300,000, and that was our seed money that we got started, and we started with that and just grew it.
How did the grant money come in and allow you to do what you did? In that 2009 period, how important was that grant money to where you sit today?
Oh, it was very important because it was the kind of revenue or the kind of money we needed to build the rural, because the rural, your customer base per mile and so forth is a lot less than it is in the right in a municipality. And with that money, the $5.2 million, I think we had to come up with approximately half of that. So the build itself was around $7 million, $7.5 million. And that enabled us to build, you know, a real large rural area around Reedsburg.
I mean, in the early days of this, did you ever get any head scratching there and saying, you know, what are you guys doing? Was there some resistance that you had to work through?
Oh, yeah. The incumbents were not happy campers that we were doing this.
When you say incumbents, explain what you mean by that.
At that time in Reedsburg, it was Charter and GTE.
Okay.
GTE was the telco and Charter was the video. And they went to the legislators and basically tried to legislate municipalities, i.e., we were electric and water utility, which we were part of the city of Reedsburg, but it's an independent entity that, you know, we answer to a board of directors. They went through the legislation, and I think today it would be very, very difficult for a municipality to do what we did because of what they passed back then.
We're talking about utility-provided internet service with Dave Mykonowicz, who worked for the Reedsburg Utility Commission for 22 years. Do you live in a rural community? What's the internet service like where you live? We're at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Brett Schuppner to the conversation. Brett is general manager now of the Reedsburg Utility Commission since taking over in 2012 upon Dave's retirement. He's helped grow the system. Brett, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Yeah, good morning, Kate and Dave.
Hi, Brett.
Well, Brett, since taking over as general manager, you've seen the utility's internet has continued to grow and connect. How large is the coverage area now?
Currently, we serve over 25% of Sauk County. Over 25% of the residents of Sauk County are capable of getting our service at this time. So,
how many would that be approximately?
Well, if you base it on Sauk County's population, I believe is around 16,000. So, mm-hmm. We pass by about 6,400 residents in Sauk County currently.
And, what does it cost residents to get internet service from the utility?
We offer, we're very unique in that regards is we offer one speed package and we don't throttle our speed. So we're capable of doing gigabit speeds and that's what we offer all our customers. The price for that is $49.95 if you live in the city of Reedsburg. And if you're in the rural areas, we do charge $10 more. So it's $59.95 for rural residents.
Would you consider that this is competitive with what private companies are charging and offering?
We're actually one of the cheaper prices, especially based on the speeds that we provide. There's a kind of an independent website out there called Broadband Now. They kind of test and monitor speeds and pricing of internet plans across the nation, and actually the last 2 years we've been recognized as having the top speeds in the nation and being one of the five most affordable internet packages in the nation.
Brett, there was a project started last year to hook up the village of Spring Green and the town of Lake Denton. Have those communities been connected?
Yep. So Lake Delton, that project is completed. Actually, we serve other areas around the Lake Delton area for the.
I'm sorry, Lake Delton. Yeah.
And then Spring Green, that project actually is currently under construction. We got quite a bit of that completed. We do have some customers already turned up, but we continue to turn up more every month down there.
And that too, there were a couple state grants there that helped get these customers connected. Is that right?
Yep. Yep, we've been taking advantage of the PSC's broadband grants that they have available. Kind of as Dave mentioned, as you build out in these rural areas, the density is less. So to, make those projects affordable and to keep the monthly service fees reasonable, then it does take some little bit of assistance to keep those prices down.
We're learning about Reedsburg's path to broadband access with the Reedsburg Utility Commission. We have Brett Mykonowicz, who worked for the commission for 22 years, put the fiber infrastructure in place. Brett Schuppner there is general manager now working to grow the system. What do you want Wisconsin and the federal government to do to help connect people in rural areas with reliable internet? Is your utility having discussions about internet? What are the barriers? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute right here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're learning about efforts over decades by the Reedsburg Utility Commission to provide internet access in rural areas of Sauk County. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In 2014, Reedsburg says it became the first internet system in the state to offer gigabit speeds. Do you lack reliable internet? How has it affected your life? What would reliable service allow you to do? Do you live in Sauk County? What was it like before the local utility established service there? Be part of this at 800-642-1234. Dave Mykonowicz is the former general manager of the Reedsburg Utility Commission, retired in 2012. Brett Shepner is GM now, continues the work of growing broadband access, and then they stay with us. So, Dave, what was internet service in Reedsburg like before the utility stepped in?
Well, basically, if you were, you know, a residential customer, you got the dial-up, the dong, 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 waited forever for your program to come up. Once we started building and the threat was there for some real competition, then the other entities, the incumbents, you know, started to get some better broadband, but we were always a step ahead with the fiber to the home because we could just offer such, you know, better speeds and really reliable service.
Well, I wonder, what has, Brett, been the effect in the community of having broadband available? What can you tell us?
Well, it does give people... Go ahead, Dave.
I was just going to say, before I even retired, I think, Brett, you were there then, too, that some group did an interview with all of our industrial customers, and it wasn't so much that we brought in new customers, but it allowed these customers to expand their services and, you know, production by having the high-speed internet.
Brett, what was that effect that you saw in the community as you were able to hook up these villages and these towns, and especially in the rural parts?
Yeah, and I guess we've heard, you know, from customers that, you know, certain like businesses maybe outgrew their current space here, you know, in town, and so then had to relocate somewhere else in town or on the edge of town. And, you know, one of the main criteria for them to do so is that to verify that we could get our fiber service to that new location. You know, we do have Land's End Distribution Center here in the city of Reedsburg, and, you know, a lot of their employees do work from home. You know, so having that reliable and internet with a fast enough speed is very important to those employees and obviously their employer. You know, so it's definitely does have an impact. You know, I think over time, since we've been here so long in the city of Reedsburg, it's kind of a little bit taken for granted that, hey, that speed's there. You know, I could do whatever I want. I don't question it. But, you know, as we build in rural areas, you know, you see the opposite. You know, they are so starved for reliable and fast internet, you know, that, you know, they when they do get our speed, it just makes a difference, a complete difference for them for what they can do and access.
We're talking about rural broadband and how the Reedsburg Utility Commission was able to access high speeds. Brett Shepner there is the utility's general manager. His predecessor, Dave Mykonowicz, retired in 2012. We heard from Ken, called in from Sirona, couldn't stay with us, but wants to know the ballpark cost of putting down about a mile of high-speed internet across Ken's land. How much would that cost, Brett?
There's quite a few variables to that, you know, what's in the, you know, what obstructions are in the way, soil conditions and all that. So, you know, if it's really good going, it could be as low as $40,000 a mile, but it could be, you know, up to $120,000 per mile. You know, it just depends on the conditions. So,
and I would assume also the geography that you're working with as well of the land.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep, definitely. That's part of it. So,
Dave, you were mentioning this earlier that in 2004, the state legislature passed a law making it harder for local municipalities to create a system like what you've got going on in Reedsburg. Do you know why it made these restrictions and what those restrictions are?
Well, some of the restrictions, I think probably the worst restriction out of that the passage of the legislature was, one of the things you had to do as a municipal utility going into the business is develop a business plan and then offer your business plan to the incumbents to review for 6 months. And what that effectively did was eliminate any possibility of private-public partnerships, because if we were, as a utility, going to somebody to, say, do our backhaul to take our information from Reedsburg down to the hubs, the private industry that we would be working with would not want to be included with us when you had to, you know, put your business plan out for everybody to look at. Plus, it gave unfair competition. Once you put that business plan out there, the incumbents would jump all over it and whatever they could do in your community just to offset you being able to build and, you know, build some revenue, they would go after it.
And those restrictions stay in place today. Is that right, Brett?
Yeah, that the legislation that was passed back then and is still in place. You know, just kind of briefly looking at what that is. I mean, what the steps, there's basically three steps that a municipality would have to take. It's prepare the report, you know, that would say the estimated cost and then your revenues and that you anticipate in a three-year cost-benefit analysis. And then you have to publish the report, make it available for public inspection for 30 days, and then hold a public hearing on this before the community could pass a resolution to move forward on that project.
Brett, you sit on the governor's new task force on broadband access, and this is a group of 24 people. We talked recently on our program with the chair, Brittany Beyer. What do you want to see happen out of that task force?
You know, I guess one main thing would be to, I guess, have the rural areas aware that there is a significant cost to provide service in those areas. And, you know, so there has to be either partnerships or the willingness of the customers and that to recognize that increased cost and be more willing to maybe to pay for that increase of service. You know, I kind of look at it on the electric side. Two, it's similar, you know, so the entire electric system got built out, but there was a cost associated with that to each individual customer. And unfortunately, like in more populated areas, you know, they see the advertisements all the time of that internet is going to be, you know, should be this price. But in rural areas, I don't know that can be and see that widespread build out that they were looking for.
We heard from Pete in Reedsburg, sent us an email saying broadband is too important now to leave in the hands of private companies for whom the last mile or last 10 miles just aren't worth it. Pete brings up that in 1935, FDR created the Rural Electrification Administration, which brought electricity for the first time to rural areas. Pete sees a similar plan here, time for something similar for internet service and the model that already exists. Dave, what do you think about that?
Oh, I think there's definitely opportunities for, you know, you've got some very very efficient co-op utilities out, you know, telcos that are probably ahead of a lot of the incumbents, much like, you know, Reedsburg did. They got some of that funding in 2010 and really built out high-speed internet to their customers. I just think, you know, you do have to have outside sources of funding come in to build in the real rural areas. I mean, even around Reedsburg, the density is better than it would be, say, up in northern Wisconsin, someplace where, you know, maybe you're going by a bunch of cabins that the people are only there for 4 or 5 months out of the year. So somewhere you have to come up with that revenue, and if you can't, you know, if you can't get it out of the customer base, there's got to be some funds put into it. But I think broadband is almost an essential service today that there should be some public financing going into it.
Brett, speaking of essential service, many Wisconsinites are jobless, struggling to pay their utilities. How is the utility working with customers? And at this time, and is internet treated like electric and water?
You know, I guess if customers are, you know, struggling due to the current, you know, situation out there, you know, being a local utility, we will work with them to you know, keep their services. But you know, once again, it has to be that they have to be working with us too. You know, just ignoring the situation and that is not a long-term solution. So, you know, and we're working with the school district to, you know, if they know families that are struggling and stuff like that, you know, at least especially on the at the tail end of the school district there, or the school last year, worked with them to provide service if there was family struggling in that end too that they were aware of. So.
Well, thank you both for joining us.
You're welcome. You're
welcome. Brett Schepner is general manager of the Reedsburg Utility Commission, and Dave Mykonowicz was his predecessor who retired in 2012. Coming up, we learn about new research that shows face masks don't just protect your neighbor from the coronavirus, that they can reduce your own risk of catching the virus. We talk with an environmental health scientist about what masks do. That's right after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're talking about mask research here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Does it matter what type of mask you wear? And what about the one in an adorable pattern that your friend or family member made for you and sent in a care package with the pattern and instructions on how to make more? Different types of masks offer different levels of protection. What questions do you have about surgical masks versus cloth masks? We're at 800-642-1234. Patricia Fabian is an associate professor of environmental health at Boston University School of Public Health, where she studies environmental health problems, including respiratory disease transmission. Patricia, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So the public health messaging around masks has been, if you wear one, you're protecting other people, but not necessarily protecting yourself. Is that true?
No, that's not true. It's been something interesting to listen on the news, this focus. You can think of masks as two-way filters. So if you're the person wearing them, it's reducing the number of particles that you are emitting. And again, if when you're breathing in, then it's reducing the number of particles that you are breathing in. How effective that is depends on how good the mask is, but it does work both ways.
And so when we say something like, well, what about a regular fabric mask? That can have so many different dimensions, I would understand, if you put that piece of material through the research and the rigor of testing.
Well, so there's a couple of ways to think about it. In occupational settings, for example, you really need a mask that works 100% or close to 100%. But in this pandemic situation, we're trying to do everything that we can to reduce transmission. So that means that even if you wear a cloth mask or a surgical mask that isn't 100% effective, it still is doing a lot to reduce contamination of the environment, exposure for yourself, exposure for others, even if it's not 100%.
Well, you know, it's interesting because back in January, February, it seems health experts were downplaying mask wearing. The CDC, the WHO in general urged people not to wear masks. But then there was this complete reversal on mask wearing by the time we got into April. What was at the heart of this flip-flop on mask wearing in public?
I don't actually know what the flip-flopping was about. For people who study infectious disease transmission, respiratory particle physics. Wearing masks is something we've been studying for a very long time. We've studied it with influenza. So I think I'm not sure why it took so long for guidelines to catch up on that. I think there was also the sense that if it wasn't something like an N95 or better, then there wasn't any point in wearing it. And so the science of just reduction and what that could do to transmission on a population level wasn't there. But scientists always knew masks work. They work to reduce, even if it's not 100%.
What about surgical masks in terms of what protections they provide?
Compared to cloth masks?
Compared to cloth masks, yes.
So I think in general, and you've seen, for example, the WHO and CDC guidelines, they'll say face coverings, cloth masks. It doesn't, from a population perspective, so a person on the street going into a store, they will all work around the same. So there's varying levels of effectiveness. But in general, again, since the goal is to reduce exposure and reduce contamination, any face covering that you wear is good. I do think there's been research showing initially they had recommended also, for example, a bandana. I think those have now been shown to maybe not be quite as good at capturing particles. But even that is better than nothing if that's what you have. Again, the goal is to reduce.
Let's look at some of these studies that have come out. There was this study using hamsters found that animals in a cage protected by a layer of surgical masks were less likely to get infected with COVID than animals without the layer of protection. And the hamsters in the cage with masks that did get COVID got less sick than those in the open cage. What did you learn there from that study?
So this was a study out of China. And there's a couple of things, you know, as you described, they put hamsters in two basically boxes, and then they moved air from the box of infected hamsters over into the box of uninfected hamsters. That was sort of the first experiment, and a lot of the hamsters got sick in that case, I think 67%. And then what they did is they put mask-like material in between the two chambers where the hamsters were and repeated the experiment, and a much lower number of hamsters got sick. Not only did less hamsters get sick, they weren't as sick as the hamsters in the first box. So this is bringing up a different theory. So one is around the reduction of particles, right, of virus particles that you get exposed to, and the idea that the dose is the poison in some ways, that the more you are exposed to more virus particles, it's possible that you'll get sicker. And so putting on masks reduces particles in two ways, right? If everybody wears one, then there's less virus in the environment. If you wear one, you're also breathing in less of whatever is in the environment. And that potentially could lead to, even if you got sick, it could either be that you become asymptomatic or that you don't have such severe symptoms.
We're talking with Patricia Fabian, who is an associate professor of environmental health at Boston University School of Public Health, talking about the health effects of putting on a mask, with your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Sam, who is joining us from Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, Sam.
Hello.
Hi.
Thanks for having me on. So, curious, over the past couple months with all of the different organizations like CDC, WHO, and other researchers, kind of like what you were saying, reversing a lot when it comes to masks, either not supposed to wear masks to not really just recommending masks, but we should legally be mandating masks. I'm kind of curious, as somebody who wants to understand the research, what things should I be looking for to know what research is worth my time, rather than get confused, and or how can I know that, you know, for example, your research at Boston University, you know, is distinguishable and legitimate as compared to maybe other research that would go contrary.
Sam, thank you. Questioning the efficacy of mask research and what is reliable. Patricia?
That's a great question. I think the whole world is struggling with trying to figure out what to believe and where to read things. You know, from a science perspective, you know, peer-reviewed journals is where a lot of the science is published. I do think still organizations like CDC and WHO are places to read. We sort of as a public need to understand that things will change, right? The reason they're changing is because we knew almost nothing about this virus in January. We didn't know that people could be asymptomatic, so they could be infected and be transmitting but have no symptoms. And as we find those things out, then you need to kind of change the guidance. And as scientists, we need to be flexible that way. As health organizations need to be flexible that way. And then as public, we need to understand that there's no sort of 100% answer to anything. And so all I can say is reading from scientific journals, reading summaries from sections of the news that are science that have a good reputation, and you know, just thinking, listening to public health officials, and being tolerant of the fact that what you may be told today, as we find out more information, might change, and that's okay. It's okay for us to be changing how we're adapting, how we might clean things in our house. You know, hopefully at one point the directions will be to kind of relax what restrictions are, cleaning things are, or masks are. But for now, and until we find out, I think, you know, it's fine to kind of have changing guidelines.
Sam, thanks. Let's bring in Alex now in Spring Green with a question. Good morning, Alex.
Good morning. I'm from Spring Green, Wisconsin, and I was certified in HAZWOPR. And my instructor, when I took the class to get the certification, said that when you're using a mask, it increases your breathing rate. And if it's not tightly sealed, more particles come in from the sides of the mask than not wearing a mask at all.
Alex, thank you for that question. Patricia, what about the seal on the mask? Couldn't that happen?
So that's a good point. And this relates to occupational health, where if you work, for example, in an environment where there's toxic particles and you have to get your test, test fitting so that the mask exactly seals around your face. What we're talking about in terms of cloth masks and surgical masks, that's never going to be the goal, and it's never going to get to that kind of a seal. The, like, you know, having sort of a rubber, this is what in occupational health, where you have HEPA filters even on those types of masks. So what you're saying is true. If it doesn't seal for those types of masks in this occupational setting, if it doesn't seal 100%, you will get leakage through the sides. That's occupational. On a population level, it's pretty impossible to think that we'll all be wearing those types of masks all day. So again, the goal is to reduce exposure, not to eliminate it, which in an occupational setting really is around eliminating exposure.
How often should you wash your mask, you know, in a cloth mask, for instance?
That's a good question. It really depends on how often you wear it and what you're doing with it when you wear it. For us, we have a spot in our house. Everybody has their spot where they put their mask, and we try to wash it at least once a week. But really what we use them for is going out occasionally to the grocery store or taking walks. If you're going to work, you know, every day wearing a mask, you might wear one or two, and you probably want to wash those at the end of the day because you've been wearing them all day.
We're talking about the latest on mask research with Patricia Fabian, an associate professor of environmental health at Boston University. What are your questions about the science of wearing masks to slow the spread of infectious disease? How have you adjusted to the new norm of wearing a mask in public? We're at 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation now with Boston University environmental health researcher Patricia Fabian. We're talking about the effects of masking up when in public and how it could be driving down rates of overall infection. Let's bring in another call now. Dwayne is joining us from Weston. Hi, Dwayne.
Oh, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
So we're, you know, dedicated firm believers of wearing masks, but what I noticed is like in China, just from watching news footage over the years, you know, when events are happening, you always see people in China wearing masks for years and years on subways or in the streets. And then secondly, the reduction in the yearly flu, I'd be interested. Can't wait to hear the statistics if that's going to drop dramatically. Are the regular influenza yearly, you know, like how it'll affect other viruses, and, you know, might be a lot less people going to the doctors for a lot of other things. And then third thing, I notice when I'm out wearing a mask, the eye-to-eye contact you make with people, at least with me, is is just way more. You just really look at people's eyes more with this mask. Something I noticed. But those are my three things.
Dwayne, thank you for bringing those observations. And the middle one there, Patricia, you have researched how mask wearing affects the spread of influenza. Can you tell us what you found?
Yes. So to the question about whether we're going to see less flu this year around the world, it's likely that we're going to see those numbers drop because similar activities as for COVID, meaning being close to people, you know, not wearing masks, going out when you're sick, et cetera, we've reduced all that. So it's likely that we'll see a reduction in flu infections, assuming other things like vaccination rates, et cetera, don't change. With regards to the research that we've done in our lab, it really was pretty similar to what we're doing with COVID, is trying to understand if you wear a surgical mask, how will that reduce the amount of virus that you put out into the environment? And one important thing we were trying to find out is, does it reduce small particles the same as larger particles? So what we did is we recruited people who had the flu. We asked them to breathe into a specially designed machine that counted and separated the particles. And what we found is that surgical masks reduced large particles, and by large, bigger than 5 micrometers in diameter, by a lot, by around 25-fold, so 25 times less. Compared to the smaller particles, it really only reduced it for about 3-fold. And so that has implications. Again, that was for influenza, but if you kind of transfer it to really any respiratory infection, like SARS, you can argue that wearing a surgical mask, and this has been part of the basis for the science that tells us wear masks, is that it reduces the number of particles that you put out into the environment.
And you can apply that then to other viruses and certainly airborne things that would be coming at someone, you know, regardless of what they are. You know, Dwayne mentioned another thing, that in China and some other countries, mask wearing has been part of the culture, if you will, and it is very new here in the U.S. And Dwayne is noticing the interpersonal contact, the more contact, eye contact that he is making with passersby. What do you observe there about mask wearing?
So in complete agreement, China has for years, or people from China have for years been wearing masks. I was lucky enough to be in Hong Kong working on an influenza study, and anybody who was sick either stayed home or wore a mask. And this comes from the fact that they have gone through epidemics before, you know, importantly, SARS-1, right, was one. And so that changes the culture. It will change our culture. I think we will see people wearing masks far into the future, even after we're not so worried about COVID, because the social stigma about it will go down. It will be seen as a responsibility that if you are feeling sick, part of your responsibility is to not get other people sick. So I think probably we will be wearing masks on subways and train stations, et cetera, far into the future. I actually think that's a good thing.
Patricia Fabian is an associate professor of environmental health at Boston University, talking about the protection masks provide in helping to stop the spread of the virus. Let's bring in Steve now, joining us from Sun Prairie. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a question. I go to a health club. I won't mention which one, but I see people on treadmills and elliptical that are working really hard and sweating really, really hard, getting in shape. And some are wearing masks, some take them off. And I know, you know, obviously the more moisture you get on a cloth mask, the more restrictive airflow is. And I'm just wondering the guest recommendation on the safety for the individual who is, you know, working out really hard wearing a mask.
Steve, thanks. Patricia?
Yeah, I think my recommendation was to put a bunch of masks in your backpack or your pocket, because it's really important to just wear it the whole time. When you exercise, and we've done research on this as well, if you're breathing normally, you exhale certain numbers of particles. If you breathe faster, obviously it's going to be more particles. If you take deep breaths and long exhalations, it's more particles. So even though it's tough to exercise with a mask, I think my recommendation would be take a bunch of masks so you can switch them out if they become uncomfortable. But taking them off, you know, puts other people at risk and yourself, because you're also breathing air, unfiltered air.
What happens if that mask gets soiled or gets really damp with perspiration?
Well, what'll happen is that it probably will block it a little more, and so you'll have more air leaking through the sides, which means it probably won't be as effective, and it will be pretty uncomfortable. So again, if what you have is a bag for dirty masks and a bag for clean masks, and you take several when you go work out, you can sort of quickly switch them out and both have the benefit of the mask still working as well as it's going to work and not be uncomfortable, right? And you can just kind of be switching them off.
Patricia, so many people have been making masks at home and distributing them to family and friends. Is there research on fabric masks and how that research you're following on these homemade masks?
Yeah, so I think there's been a couple papers out on what the effectiveness is. I think at the end of the day, it has to be a combination of reducing enough particles and a good enough fit and comfortable enough fit that you will wear it for as long as you need to wear it. So I think the latest paper that I read was recommending using quilting cotton as being something that's kind of a tighter weave, but lets you breathe enough and comfortable enough on your face. I'm sure that will continue changing. And I know that there's research looking into different materials that might also be comfortable, but have other types of properties where they could capture particles.
Do you think there will be any attempts to standardize the kinds of fabric used for these masks that are on the market that people can buy?
I think probably eventually that will be the case. But again, you will always have leakage around these masks.
Mm-hmm.
So if the goal is to reduce, make them comfortable enough for people to wear, there will be a wide range of what fits that description. And again, it's about reducing on a population level exposure, not eliminating. So I think a wide range of materials and mask designs will probably fit that.
It's interesting that you say that at the end of this crisis that the U.S. will see much more mask wearing. Do you see any other pivotal moments here in public health that we will take away from this crisis?
So many. I think one thing that's been really amazing for me to see as a public health professional is people's interest in public health. So many more people are going to be studying it. It's a field that maybe doesn't really get as much attention and funding as, for example, medicine. But we're seeing with an epidemic like this how important public health is, just for infection, but also for support systems and social networking, et cetera. So that is a big pivot into saying public health is important. We'll have to invest in this at a city level, you know, at a state level, at a country level. And that's really gratifying as a public health professional to see.
Well, Patricia, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Patricia Fabian is an associate professor of environmental health at Boston University, where she studies environmental health problems. We are hearing, by the way, the song So Fresh, So Clean by Outkast. The song's chorus is about 20 seconds, or how long we're supposed to wash our hands with soap or sanitizer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. Stay with us on the Ideas Network.